Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Helen Crane, with special guest appearance from Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, a 10 grand bung for fitting a heat pump, a tax on our boilers, the cost of going green in our homes. Is inflation back on the rise? How worried should we be by the latest figures? And where next for interest rates? Meanwhile, millions face a big price hike for their mobile and broadband from March. Isn't it time that these inflation-busting mid-contract increases were banned? Also today, following campaigning by This Is Money for years for fair treatment for parents who don't qualify for child benefit, mums denied state pension credits will get them. Tanya explains all you need to know. Plus, a bungled handover to a new administrator has left BAE Systems retirees suffering drastic cuts in their pensions. And Crane is back on the case, this time over a robot vacuum cleaner. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the government is getting out the carrots and the sticks in a move to improve the energy efficiency in our homes. To help meet its carbon emission targets, you can get up to $7,500 to have a new heat pump fitted in your home. But need a new boiler? Watch out for a boiler tax. Hey, Boyce, what is the actually titled clean heat market mechanism?
Yeah, that is the most dull name, isn't it, ever? So it's coming in from April. It's a plan from the government, basically, that will give each manufacturer of gas and oil boilers credits for fitting a certain number of heat pumps per year. If manufacturers don't hit these targets, individual targets for each firm, they face fines of £3,000 per missing credit. Now, what the kind of boiler manufacturers have spun this round to say is it's almost like a boiler tax, and people are going to have to pay more for a gas and oil boiler in the future. And in fact, some of them have already pinned some price hikes already on this because they're saying that they're going to have to pass on the cost, essentially. The government says these targets are realistic and achievable, right? And the targets are, I think they're pretty big, and we'll talk them through in a sec. And they do offer grants, which we're going to talk about as well shortly. But they are saying that any reports and anything that's labelling this a boiler tax is completely inaccurate. So I should put that out there right now. They're not happy with this being called a boiler tax. So this incentive, this is what the industry's labelled it. It's not a term. This is what, you know, the boiler manufacturers are kind of saying, and you know, you have to listen to both sides of the argument. And this, the kind of targets from the government is installing at least 600,000 heat pumps in UK homes per year by 2028, and we are miles off of that. I'm not saying they're not saying that there needs to be 600,000 by this year. It's a gradual kind of tick up on how many need to be done. But there's some stats here, right? In the UK, there's only 564 heat pumps per 100,000 households, but in Europe, the take up is much sort of stronger. So countries like Norway, they have one heat pump per 3.4 people, according to these stats.
They're do in Norway?
Well, they're probably more suited, to be quite frank, right, to homes in especially those Scandinavian countries, where, you know, lots of colder for longer, and potentially have more space to put one of these heat pumps. They take up quite a big amount of space. So when you think about a gas boiler, for example, and you have it nestled somewhere inside your home, heat pumps are outside of your home, and they're quite big. So you have two types of heat pumps, right? So you have air source heat pumps. They convert air from outside to water, which heats your home via radiators and underfloor heating. And you have ground source heat pumps, and these transfer heat from the ground outside to heat your home. Ground source air pumps tend to be a bit more expensive to install and require more outdoor space. And there's lots of pros and cons, George, with heat pumps. And there's been a lot of chat around it. You know, some of the cons that people were kind of mentioning quite a lot is the higher cost of putting them in. Quite often, traditional heating systems and the plumbing just don't work. They can't coexist with a heat pump. So you have to have all of that sort of, you know, sorted out. And it's could be a big project getting one of these fitted. You know, gas boilers are pretty relatively easy job with a qualified engineer who will come in and out and do it. But this is a little bit more upheaval. But they do have pros. You know, it's not like we're being asked to put these into our homes and they're absolutely rubbish. You know, the argument is that they reduce the carbon footprint. That's why there's been a big push onto homes, you know, basically to get one, because they're utilizing free thermal energy. So you could save 10% off your energy bill per year, but is that 10% high enough to really get people involved in doing this? You know, it's hard. And there is also this boiler scheme grant. So basically the government is offering incentives to get a heat pump put into your home up to $7,500. But is it tempted enough people into getting it and ditching the gas boiler? I mean, when you look at the figures of how many are being fitted, you would probably argue not. So Worcester Bosch said 60,000 heat pumps are fitted in the UK each year, whereas boiler installations, traditional boiler installations, 1.5 million a year. That's a massive swing to try and get around, isn't it? And I mentioned Worcester Bosch here because they're offering an extra £2,500 grant on top of that government grant to get one of its heat pumps fitted into your home. So that's that's a big incentive. That's £10,000, essentially. I think quite a few people could be tempted into that and making the leap if it's going to be pushed onto us anyway. But there's going to be a lot of resistance as well. And that's what the industry and the government is going to have to try and get over and tackle in order to meet the targets.
You know, I like to multitask when we're doing this podcast, because I mean, I'm now curious as to why heat pumps are so popular in Norway. So alongside listening to what you were saying there, there's a reason why it's particularly popular in Norway. I mean, one, they already are quite well advanced on their insulation in their homes. But actually, this is the key thing, one of the key things, which is what you were saying, is they trained up a workforce to install them. So while the devices themselves can be churned out en masse in factories, the problem is having people trained to fit them into our homes. They also say that they work really well, which I hear differing responses to it. So, you know, and that's the problem. If you hear one bad, you know, issue with it, they do take a little bit longer to heat up the home. You know, you do sort of sense, is this a bit of beta technology that they're using? And you, honestly, Lee, you'd be surprised at how much I can learn while you're also telling me at the same time. That's the journalistic impulse in me. Helen, your thoughts about heat pumps. Is this the sign of things to come, though? These sort of carrot and stick measures, and I'm thinking more about the sticks, the taxes, the levies, whatever you want to call it, by the government who have to meet these emission targets. Essentially, it's just going to fall on us to sort out our homes.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're right. This is, if you want to get a heat pump anyway, this is a pretty decent incentive. But I think the thing that's kind of being ignored in a lot of this is that a lot of homes, as they are today, aren't going to be suitable for a heat pump. So, for example, if you've got, if you live in a flat, you can't get a heat pump because you don't have any outdoor space. It's not possible. They're not very good for old houses because although heat pumps are very green, as you said, they're not always as good as a boiler at heating your home to the same level of kind of temperature. So if you have a home that isn't very well insulated, you might be told that your home isn't really suitable for a heat pump because the heat will kind of leak too much. There's a lot of reasons that you might not be able to have one. I think the figure is around 25% of houses wouldn't be suitable for a heat pump as they are today. So I think it's a case of, yes, it's a good idea, but aside from just the pure cost of installing it, your home might not actually be suitable for one anyway. You know, you're talking about Norway. I imagine a lot of homes there are bigger, you know, they've got gardens, they've got the space for this. And they're also probably more modern and built in a way that, you know, a heat pump would suit
heat
that.
In, basically.
Yeah,
as
exactly.
Well.
Because they have to. Yeah, so I think, you know, it is clearly there are benefits this, but you know, the article we wrote about this week, a lot of people in the comments were saying, well, look, you know, my friend's got a heat pump and I've been to their house and I had to keep my coat on because it was quite cold. And you know, I'm not saying that's the case all the time, but it seems from people's anecdotes about having them fitted that if your house isn't perfectly suited, it might not kind of spread heat around as well. So I think maybe just, you know, we need a bit more education. You're right, maybe the products need to kind of improve, and you know, I think people need a bit more guidance on how this would work in the home, and maybe that'll come with just more people getting them fitted, and as you said, the technology will develop and you know, there'll be more qualified people to install them, and that will sort of bring the cost down. But I think it is very early days for a lot of people, and when it's something that does cost so much, even if you are getting a grant, you know, it is something people are definitely, kind of thinking twice about.
Lee, seeing you there all dressed up in your beanie hat and what looks like a very fleecy top, very warm gilet. No such thing as bad weather, only bad clothes, Lee. Oh, you have no idea how many times I say that this winter. Have you got a heat pump? What would stop you?
I don't have a heat pump, Georgie, and I did have to replace the boiler just before the pandemic. Actually, we were fairly lucky. We had a winter 2019 in which the boiler packed up, which was not ideal with a one-year-old at the time. We got a new boiler fitted, just a traditional gas boiler. But to be honest, heat pumps quite niche. I don't think we were really talking about them out in the open, to be quite frank. The big drawback for me, I think there's two big drawbacks. One is, I think it's just a bit more work getting it installed and thinking about having to replace radiators and all that kind of stuff. I think what needs to be done is potentially having an assessment of your home to say, okay, this is suitable or it's not suitable, and this is what you would need in order for this to work and to happen. Because if you start telling people that they've got to rip out radiators and plumbing and things to get a heat pump, I think people start to panic and it sounds like a massive job. And the other thing is, it is the cost. So going back to Worcester Bosch, they're saying that an air source heat pump typically costs £8,000 to install, and a ground source heat pump will set you back £20,000. Now, a typical gas boiler costs between £1,500 and £5,000. Depending on the size and type required, you're likely to be in the middle of that, probably like about £3,000, something like that. And I think that is a massive stumbling block, even with grants. I think that it's hard to really get people involved, get people sort of saying, you know what, we need a new boiler and let's make it, we'll change to a heat pump. I think, and I'd like to think, that if that was the case now, if you needed your boiler replacing, and you had the conversation with whoever it is, you know, the manufacturer or whoever it is, an engineer, it's about, as Helen says, it's about education. It's about saying, okay, well, look, you can get a boiler. You can still get a boiler, a gas boiler. They're still on sale. You know, there's nothing changing on that front. But if you did go to a heat pump, here's where it would go. Here's what we would need to do. Here's the cost. Here's the cost for a gas boiler, and here's what cost for a heat pump with grants. Here's your options. Which one would you like to pick? Rather than saying you've got to have a heat pump and it needs to go up there, and it is, you know, I think that's what gets people's backs up. And I think people just, they look unsightly. They just do not look nice on the side of a home. And you know, depending on what model you get, you know, I've heard various reports of them being quite noisy. Do we want more noise pollution? Just not convinced. And then I think, oh, it's out in the elements, you know, exposed to outside, and you know, how I don't know. There's lots of questions for me. And to be honest with you, it's one of those things where I'm not going to sit here and just bash heat pumps. That's just not what we're in the market to do. You know, as I've laid out some of the pros and some of the cons, and we'd love to hear from listeners who've had heat pumps installed and tell us, you know, has it been a good choice for you? Have you seen your energy bills come down? Was it not as much work as what you expected? On the flip side of that, do you regret it? Is it rubbish? You know, let's find out. This clean heat market mechanism, which comes in April, it's coming in, and it basically means that 4% of boiler sales, or firm boiler sales for the next financial year, 2024-2025, would need to be 4%. So 4% of installations of boilers will need to be heat pumps, and that will rise to 6% in 2025-2026, and it's going to keep nudging a little bit higher. Is the onus on the household and the homeowner to make the decision, or is it some gentle help with some education from installers, from boiler manufacturers, from the government, saying, you know, we can give you a free 15-minute kind of like MOT of your house to say, this is where it would go, this is how much it would cost, and this is how much it could save you. You up for it? Yeah, great. But I think sometimes people get a little bit het up when it almost feels like it's forced on you. You know, these targets are forced, and, you know, people start to go, oh, I'm going to have to get a heat pump. You know, that's what I'm being told. It's not quite like that. It's a kind of more gentle approach. And the more we can sort of
get educated on it and find out more information. And the more people we know, as you say, that have them done and get the feedback from, the better. I'm sure it will just become, you know, a bit more normalised.
All right, then. We got the latest cost of living figures out this week. And to the surprise of many economists and the displeasure of the government, no doubt, inflation ticked up a smidge from 3.9% to 4% in December. But what is 0.1% between friends? Helen, who cares?
I mean, yeah, it does sound like a very small change on paper, but this has been, it's been billed as quite a shock, actually. I think because people were expecting inflation to continually edge downwards. It's been going down for a few months now. We've got down to this kind of 3.9% level in November, which everyone was quite pleased about. You know, there was a good reaction to that in things like mortgage prices, and everyone was kind of feeling quite good. So I think even though it is a tiny uptick from 3.9 to 4%, it's gone up. It's a bit of a shock. It suggests that maybe this trajectory that everyone thought was going to happen won't kind of happen quite as smoothly. I don't think anyone's saying necessarily that inflation is going to kind of rocket back up to the 7, 8, 9% levels that we were seeing last year. But it's just kind of given everyone a bit of pause for thought. It's like, oh, you know, maybe the course isn't going to run quite as smoothly as we perhaps thought. So I think it's given people a little bit of a shock, basically, and that's fed into people's forecasts about where the base rate is going to go later this year, which is kind of the important thing when you're looking at things like, you know, savings, mortgage rates, the cost of bills. The expectation now after those results is maybe 5 interest rate cuts in 2024. People previously were saying there'd maybe be 6 cuts, and the first is going to come probably in May or June. So the cuts to the base rate coming maybe slightly later and maybe fewer cuts by the end of 2024 is what the analysts are saying.
Lee, I'm surprised that it was a surprise that it went up, because the Bank of England is saying, everybody chill out. I mean, the markets may have got super overexcited, but the Bank of England have gone, whoa, hold your horses. Are you taking a look over what happened in America, in the Eurozone, particularly France and Germany? Is this such a massive surprise?
I don't think it's a huge surprise, Georgie, to be honest. I mean, the expectations were it was going to nudge to 3.8%, and instead it nudged the other way to 4%. It's not like it's some sort of catastrophe, you know, and we all need to panic all of a sudden. And this index could be, you know, quite temperamental. So basically the main driver of it this time is alcohol and tobacco. So basically, if you don't drink and you don't smoke, well, your personal inflation rate is probably not going to be as high as this. And then you look at into the details a little bit further, and the biggest faller was food and non-alcoholic beverages. Food inflation is still rampant and it's still high, but at least there's some signs there that potentially it's going to start dropping off. And looking ahead and putting a positive spin on this, you know, there's lots of expectations, for example, that energy prices will fall between sort of now and the summer. And that could have a quite big bearing on this inflation rate. So that could help bring it down. But there's all sorts of variables and things that can happen. So, for example, one of the big things that jumps into my mind is what happens next with petrol prices, because petrol prices are actually at a relatively low level compared to where they've been in recent years. And one crisis, as we've seen in the past couple of weeks, can start ticking oil prices higher, can then start being reflected in the forecourts. And then that becomes the main driver of what's, you know, either helping push inflation a little bit higher or helping it stay stubborn. So there's lots of sort of variables and things that could go on. And, you know, we as you said, we were talking about the base rate and where it's heading next, and there was market expectations for 6 cuts. Some people said 4 cuts, some people said 5 cuts. The most of the expectations are that there are going to be cuts. And it's just when that happens, whether it be May, June, July, bearing some mad stuff happening between there and them, which mad stuff can happen. That is how markets are currently pricing it in. And I think you only have to look at what's happening, for example, in the mortgage. We won't go massively into mortgages today because I feel like mortgages have just been, you know, there's just been so much mortgage coverage in the last sort of few weeks. But lenders are still cutting rates. Santander this week cut its 2-year fix. And it's closing in on 4%. So we've got 5-year fixes under 4%. Now we've almost got 2-year fixes.
Give me some context. about that. Sorry, Lee, but you know, you so you can get a Virgin for 3.92 for a 5-year, I think, depending on your deposit. But how does that compare previously to sort of normalish times? And how do you think that's going to look in a year or so?
Well, I define normalish times, Georgie. I mean, the thing
that's true.
You know, if you're talking about the period between the financial crisis and the pandemic, which, you know, is that normal times? Well, it wasn't really, because we were in sort of super low rates, in which, you know, I've said it time and time again, but to be able to fix your mortgage for 5 years under 1%, it just now seems absolutely bananas. But that was the world that we were in. We were in ultra low base rate, you know, 0.1%. And, you know, that's what a lot of us have got used to. Homeowners have got used to those kind of those rates. I think what you're seeing now is mortgage rates that are nowhere near as high after the mini budget fiasco of September 2022, and essentially it's steadied the boat somewhat. And banks are, it's not completely linked to base rate what banks do with their mortgage book, but you know, we've come in a time last year where house sales were down a fifth. Mortgage lenders are all of a sudden needing to get a bit competitive, and you know, swap rates are sort of kind of steadying somewhat, and mortgage rates seem to have steadied in response. Now, we've had some kind of brokers this week suggesting that actually, if anything, now this is the end of the road for the mortgage cuts. And there might be a kind of repricing going on. It's almost like a New Year fire sale that's happened to try and get some business through the door. And then, you know, there's the possibility that these deals aren't going to be around forever. But no suggestion that rates are going to be going, you know, supersonic again in terms of mortgages. And a lot of that is linked to what banks think will happen to base rate over the next year. So there's little signs that, you know, hopefully brighter times are ahead. You know, we have really suffered. I think I'll go back to food inflation. I mean, it's just such a vitally important thing. Obviously, a huge expense for households. And if you're seeing costs of staples going up 20, 30, 40% in the last 2 years, that is far from ideal. And I'm hoping that, you know, we're coming to the end of the road of those kind of those kind of hikes. Does this sort of set of data this week put that into doubt? I'm not sure. I really don't think it does. It is such a small swing. If you were talking a little bit more than that, then maybe. But yeah. I don't know. It feels like when alcohol and tobacco are the main driver, you know, I would say the vast majority of people in this country don't smoke.
Dry January
then,
as well. So
yeah, we've got dry January on the go, but then we've had reports of non-alcoholic beers prices.
That's true.
Going up and all that kind of stuff. So you know, it's you're right, but I'm sure that would be factored into this, no doubt. So you know, let's see what the next set of data shows us. I think it then gives a bit of a clearer indication. If it nudges higher again, then I think you're in a kind of like, okay, well that's now a trend, rather than just a one-off. You know, I don't know what expectations are for the next set of data, but I think it's far from needing to be in panic stations.
Well, that's good, Lee. Helen Lee saying there that perhaps we sort of stabilised with the mortgage drama. Who knows what's going to happen? Can attention now turn to renters? Because they look to be in a bit of trouble this year.
Yeah, I mean, all this mortgage price stuff it inevitably has an impact on renters, because you know their landlords might have a mortgage. You know, we are still seeing rents go up by a huge amount. You know, some obviously there's these different indexes, but one that I saw last week said rents have gone up 20% in the last 2 years, which I just think it's completely unsustainable, to be honest. I do think, you know, we're seeing all these figures come out saying more young people are sort of staying at home with their parents than ever before, and I personally I do feel that we're kind of coming to a bit of a crunch time with the cost of rent, to be honest. It's absolutely, you know, talking to people that I know, rents have gone up huge. You know, we're talking hundreds of pounds a year for a lot of people, and I do think it's going to get to a bit of a crunch time for the rental market. I think at some point in the next couple of years, rents are going to have to not go down, you know, rents never really go down, but stop rising at the rate they are, because it's just got completely unsustainable.
Agreed. All right. Meanwhile, though, December's CPI inflation figure is important for anyone who has broadband or mobile, which, let's be honest, is probably most of us. It is what many companies use to increase their prices between March to May. But don't expect your bill to go up 4% mid-contract. Oh, no, Lee Boyce. That's far too low. We need to pay much more than that, don't we? How much can we expect to pay for our broadband and mobile between March and May?
Oh, Georgie, this one gets me. It gets me going. I kind of don't know how we've got into this position in which we've kind of accepted that telecoms firms can put up basically your bill by inflation, December's inflation measure, plus 3.9%. It really winds me up. And of course, with the 4% figure, that would be 7.9%. That would mean an extra 18 quid a year on average for phone users, mobile phone users, and depending on what contract you are on, could be far higher than that. And broadband customers face an extra £36 a year. Again, that could vary depending on what contract you're on and how much you're paying already. The thing is, these are already baked into contracts, so there's not much you can really do about it, because when you sign the terms and conditions, it is in there. And I think that the likelihood is most people are fully aware now that these are there. Now, there are meant to be changes afoot. Ofcom did say before Christmas that it was thinking about a ban on mid-contract inflation-linked price hikes, and it's sort of consulting on that at the moment. I think there was also sort of talk of, if they are going to do this, before you sign a contract, to give you real breathing, living examples of what it would do to your bill over the course of your contract. So I would argue that usually on a mobile phone, you're typically looking at a 2-year contract. So it should show you any rises in year one and year two, what that's going to take your bill to. I don't think they really make it that clear at the moment. Some people now take out 3-year contracts, given the price of some handsets. And again, it's impossible for a consumer to know what their bill is going to be in 2 or 3 years' time, because they don't know what the rate of inflation is going to be. They're not thinking that far ahead. They're looking at the price here and now, 25 quid a month, lovely. And then by the end of your contract, it's much more than that. And you're kind of thinking, well, how does that happen? And we just kind of swallow it and accept it. And I think that it's good that Ofcom are looking at this and you know, potentially making changes to it. And I think that for me, it's just a practice that I don't think that's quite right.
No, I don't think so.
They just hide behind the terms and conditions. And also, you know, whenever you look at any of these adverts online or you see them on the television, you know, they do have to put it in italics at the bottom of the kind of screen saying a contract will rise by 3.9% plus inflation. You know, that's how they get away with it. It's not like they're completely hiding it. And you know, they have to make it fairly clear, but are they making it clear enough is the argument. And that's what Ofcom are kind of looking at the moment. But, you know, they will use this December inflation figure. It's not as high as last December. So I remember thinking, wow, these are going to be some absolute sizable whacks. You know, but 7.9% is still a meaty enough hike for people, you know, who as we were just saying, you know, food prices, inflation. I'm really loath to say the cost of living crisis anymore, just because
crunch.
It's got to a point now where it's like, well, cost of living crisis. We're quite a few years into it. Do we still call it a cost of living crisis? I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a crisis of my own confidence in what I'm saying.
This is really interesting, because I have, when I write articles about it now, I call it a crunch rather than crisis, just to stick with the C and keep cost of living in. But actually, I'm feeling it too. Like, and also, we've said this so many times, that actually for many people, it's not a crisis. Like, if you don't have a mortgage and, you know, a very energy efficient home, and it's just a bit of a crunch.
Yeah, exactly.
Some people, it's a disaster.
Well, one thing I think we can agree on is that none of us want to see our bills rise, whether it's from a kind of telecoms firm or it's a food bill or whatever it is. You know, we've all faced those higher cost pressures. But I think that this is a practice that might one day fairly soon not but then Georgie, what the telecom firms will likely do is find another way of, you know, doing something that they're not going to be out of pocket. They'll find a way. It will
obviously
it will either mean that your bill is just going to be higher from the start, is probably the most likelihood, isn't it? You think about it, if they were banking on an extra amount of money over the course of your 2 year period, they'll probably just inevitably put it in to the very start, you know, just spread out a bit more. That's what that's what the danger is of something like this, where you think, well, that's a great thing if they stop the mid contract hikes, but it's not such a great thing if you can't get it on the price that you were expecting and what you've got used to. So we'll be keeping a beady eye on what happens and where it goes, but none of us want our broadband bill, our mobile bill, our telecoms bills to be going any higher. Otherwise, we're just going to get to the point where we'll just go, let's not have a mobile phone anymore, just chuck it in the river, which sometimes I'm quite tempted to do.
Helen, I'm a bit confused about the sort of reasoning of these firms as to why they're doing it. Now, they say it's to sort of fix stuff, maintenance and all that sort of jazz. Well, what's the point of the inflation rise then? I assume they're not paying all their staff an increase of that amount in inflation. But be that as it may, if you don't like it, can you cancel?
Yeah, I agree on the point that it is quite opaque where these increased sort of costs to them of providing your mobile phone contract are coming from. You know, with things like food, you can see it a bit more clearly. You know, the cost of raw materials costs more and the cost of shipping costs more. But yeah, I agree. It's slightly, you know, I hope that, you know, some of it is going to pay their staff more. But, you know, who knows? We don't really get that information. It is unfortunately difficult to get out of a mobile phone contract. They'll quite often say, because as Lee said, you know, inflation linked hikes are part of the sort of small print that you sign up to. Generally, if you try and cancel, they will make you pay off the rest of the contract before you can do that. It is unfortunate. There are ways you can kind of make your bill a bit cheaper, though, once you do get to the end of a contract. If your mobile phone still works, you're happy with it, switch to a SIM-only deal. I think a lot of people get caught out. You know, some firms will sneakily, once you finish paying off the phone, because a lot of bills are kind of split into paying for the handset and paying for the minutes and data now. So once you finish paying for your handset, once that's paid off, it's really important to check that your bill has gone down to reflect that. Some mobile phone companies will do that automatically, but others won't. So if that doesn't happen, then switch to a SIM-only deal if you're still happy with your phone, so you're only paying for your minutes and data rather than a phone that you know that the bill's already cleared for. It is also worth, I think, looking at different networks. I did this last year. I kind of assumed before that, you know, all mobile phone providers cost about the same. You know, oh, if I switch from one to another, am I really going to save that much money? I thought you probably wouldn't. But I had a bit of an audit of, you know, my sort of finances at the end of last year. And I actually did have a shop around because my contract had finished. I'm actually saving quite a lot of money. I switched to one of the budget networks. I was with one of the, you know, big household name ones, and I've switched to one of these new sort of smaller ones. It's actually been really good. I'm paying about half what I was paying before. I got a slightly newer phone. I'm on a 2-year contract instead of a 3-year contract, which is good. And yeah, more data, it's all working perfectly fine. And people may be a bit scared of like changing network, but it's worked out really well for me. So I'd say it definitely is worth shopping around and not just sticking with the same one.
Good advice as always, Helen. After years of campaigning, This Is Money won a victory for parents who don't qualify for child benefit, but would stand to lose tens of thousands of pounds in their old age if they didn't claim it anyway. Now the government has announced that mums who missed out on state pension credits will be able to claim them from April 2026. The fix will cover all parents affected, going back to the overhaul of child benefit in 2013. Tanya, warm welcome to the pod. Just explain to us, if you would, because I don't think it's very well known, this link between child benefit and state pension credits, and therefore why we were in this situation, why you've been campaigning for 5 years in the first place.
Well, it is a really obscure link that a lot of people don't know about, which is one of the major problems with it. It did start back in 2013 when there was a big overhaul of child benefit, and people on incomes of over 50,000 started having their child benefit taken away, and 60,000 income from one partner, it gets taken away altogether. So as a result, a lot of people didn't qualify for child benefit any longer and didn't apply or register for it because they didn't qualify for the payments. But this started causing problems because of this link with the state pension. If you weren't registered, then you can lose these very valuable credits, which are, you need 35 years for a full state pension, and they're obviously worth 1/35th. and it adds up to tens of thousands of pounds in retirement if you end up needing them. Some people won't because they go back to work, they pay national insurance, but those who do need them really need them, and it creates a massive hole in your state pension record. And that's all very well, but they weren't giving people any opportunity to fix that. When people belatedly realised there was a problem, those who did realise, I think there's a lot of people out there who never realised, they got their credits backdated for 3 months, the same as they did their payments. Now, payments is one thing. I mean, obviously, if you apply late, it's going to be clawed back off you anyway if you don't qualify. But the credits were the crucial thing. It was just so unfair and ridiculous. So we started campaigning on it about 6 years ago now. And they announced, thankfully, a year ago that they were going to sort it out, but they didn't say how until now. I'll be honest with you, Georgie, I'm amazed it took them that long to sort it out. Because
are you?
Yeah, well, I am actually, because it was such an obvious thing to fix. It was creating a completely unnecessary hole in so many parents' state pensions through no fault of their own. I mean, who applies for a benefit they don't qualify for? Most people would shy away from that, and they understandably weren't doing that. And on top of that, nobody really understood the link. They did some research at one point as to whether people did know anything about it, and embarrassingly discovered literally nobody knew, which they ended up having to publish. It's great news that they finally fixed it. It's obviously not before time, but it's not going to happen until 2026. Because parents now have got such a long time before they reach state pension age, I don't think the delay is necessarily going to be a problem, because they're nowhere near the age where it becomes important.
So, Tanya, what then would you have to do? I mean, are the government going to automatically give you these credits? Do you have to prove anything?
They haven't given too much detail. It's about four paragraphs of detail, which is not an awful lot. But what they have said is that people will have to apply to get the credits. You'll be able to go back 6 years, but there is going to be transitional arrangements to make sure that the people who might have missed out since 2013 still can. Now, they haven't said how long that transition is going to be, and so that could cause further problems for some people. If there's a cutoff, that means that I suppose that some people who very, very belatedly realise, perhaps even at retirement age, could still have a hole, but I don't know because they haven't said that yet. And there's a couple of other areas which are potential problems. One is grandparents who would have got credits as a result of their adult children having credits that they could pass on to them. And it's not yet clear if it's going to be sorted for them as well. There is also the issue that some people have bought state pension top-ups over the years to fill gaps. And we don't yet know yet what their status is going to be. In terms of what you're going to have to prove, I do not know, but it will probably be something to do with, were you looking after your children in the years that you're applying for? In the past, when they've been pushing forward very weak arguments, in my opinion, as to why they couldn't fix it, in response to a petition that Steve Webb ran, they were forced to respond because he got so many signatures on it. They said that they couldn't be sure that parents could prove they were looking after their own children further back than 3 months, which was just completely ridiculous. Of course they can. Anyone who's a parent knows that they've got absolutely loads of admin which could easily prove, you know, that they're going to school, they're going to the doctor, they're doing this, they're doing that. There's loads of ways you can prove that you were you know, living at the same address with your own children. So it might be something like that, I suppose.
Just finally on this one, Tanya, I mean, great that the government's enabling those people who've missed out to now claim, but what are they doing for those people in the future who have absolutely no idea about this? It just doesn't seem to be fixing a problem for the future. Do you know what I mean? You know this system better than any of us here. What can be done?
Well, I think you're still going to have to register for child benefit. I think that the issue is that if you make the mistake, you'll be able to fix it going back at least 6 years and possibly longer. It may well be that if you've got a good reason, you will go back to 2013. They do that sometimes, and then you would have to give a reason why you, and if the reason is I didn't know that I had to claim, that would be quite a good one. They do have that for when people put the wrong partner's, wrong in inverted commas, partner's name on a child benefit form. That happens a lot, and you can swap it over if the person who was claiming didn't actually need the credits because they were paying national insurance anyway, and therefore the parent who needed them missed out. You can do that, and we did have to fight a battle over that because there was a time limit on that, but they created a kind of, you know, unofficial loophole really, where if you had a good reason, which includes I didn't know, then you can get it sorted. So let's hope it's going to be something along those lines. You don't actually have to claim the child benefit and then receive the payments and have to go through all the hassle of filling in a self-assessment form. What you do when you register and don't qualify, but you just want the credits, is you just tick a box saying no payments, credits, so credits only. They have made that part easy, but it's still an important thing to do.
All right, then. Meanwhile, while we have you, Tanya, complaints have been flooding in to This Is Money from furious and pretty stressed out BAE Systems pensioners, and now a bungled handover to a new administrator left them with drastic cuts of up to 50% in their pensions. Tanya, explain what has happened here. What is this about? Handovers to new administrators? What are tax codes? Tell us the story.
Well, we were contacted by someone who was affected by this. BAE Systems Pension Scheme changed its administrator last summer, last August. And in the changeover month, both administrators ran the payroll, which basically means they informed HMRC that the pensions had been paid. Therefore, it looked like they'd been paid twice, even though they were only paid once. And HMRC changed everybody's tax codes. Even though this happened in the summer, it doesn't seem to be until December that HMRC started making these really massive deductions. The first reader who got in touch with us was facing a demand for £12,000 in total in the year. And he'd already had about 1,300 taken over 2 months, and he was facing that continuing up to 12,000. After we published the original story, we were absolutely deluged with more cases, some of which are cases of hardship where people really struggled. And you can imagine that the timing just before Christmas, suddenly having your pension income halved in December, it's one of the most inconvenient times of the year for that to happen. And people, at least one person, probably a lot more, had a really miserable Christmas because suddenly they had no money for that month.
So what have all the companies involved been saying?
Well, we've been pressing them to sort this out, as you can imagine. They do say that they have got a scheme-wide fix in place now with HMRC. Obviously, it would be much better if this scheme-wide fix had been applied before the deductions started. But they are saying that people's next payments should be sorted and that people will be reimbursed if they have had a massive tax deduction incorrectly applied. So we'll have to see. We've had more responses in this morning to the story that we published a few hours ago, and we'll have to see what comes in. And I think if people's next payments aren't sorted out, we'll have even more irate people getting in touch with us. But let's hope they have got to grips with it. But the people I obviously feel sorry for are the pensioners. Their scheme changed administrator, and it's now changed administrator again because the one that took it over has now sold their pension administration business to a third company who took it over on January the 1st. So they're now in play as well. We'll have to hope that they are efficient. We'll have to wait and find out. But it's caused a lot of problems for people, not just financially, but the stress and inconvenience. And also, a lot of people have had to spend absolutely ages on the phone to HMRC because the schemes and the administrator who was in charge in the second half of last year basically said that you have to take this up and fix your tax code with HMRC yourself. Well, we know that at least 33,000 pensioners were affected, and we also know that HMRC is absolutely jammed at the moment in terms of its phone lines, especially at this time of year when everyone's getting their tax returns sorted. And it's been an absolutely miserable experience. A lot of the pensioners are particularly upset that it was put on them to sort it out for themselves.
Tanya, thank you so much for joining us to discuss that. Lee, I could see you shaking your head during that. Yeah, you're not impressed, are you?
Well, Georgie, I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about the BAE thing. In fact, I haven't got a bee in my bonnet. I've got a beehive in my bonnet about this one. I think it's absolutely despicable what's gone on here. I mean, to be asked for this to happen, you know, system errors happen, like we understand it. But I think they put the onus on people to phone up HMRC, which fills absolutely anyone with dread trying to phone up the tax man to try and sort something out, let alone something that's, you know, fairly complicated like this in terms of trying to explain and probably having to explain to various people in, you know, all sorts of departments and probably never speaking to the same person twice. I just don't think it's acceptable. And as Tanya says, it's tens of thousands of pensioners who've been sort of caught up in this. And it's just the tired, you know, the kind of tireless, dogged determination of Tanya that gets these cases, gets her teeth stuck into it and doesn't let it drop. That, you know, I cannot tell you the amount of work that goes on behind the scenes to make stories like this stand up. You know, it's what all well and good we get people telling us their stories, but we have to kind of stand it up and make sure it's an incredible amount of work. And as Tanya says, we will be keeping an eye on this. And if this isn't fixed in by the end of this month and it rumbles on to next month, you know, we are talking more stories and throwing more weight behind this because it is simply not acceptable. Tens of thousands of pensioners, Georgia, for something that feels is so innocuous and sort of, yeah, it's not their fault whatsoever. It's not a kind of anything that any of the people that are in this pension scheme have done, yet they're the ones that have been penalised. We've had people writing in saying it's ruined Christmas, you know, because they rely on those payments and those payments have been halved. I mean, that's, you can't get that Christmas back, can you? You know, and, you know, it's a case of once this is sorted and ironed out and all done and dealt with, you know, I think the next kind of cause for kind of what we should be doing next is talking about, well, Tanya has done this in the story, but, you know, compensation, redress for people that, you know, as I say, can't get those Christmases back, might have had to really kind of skimped and kind of struggled because of a error that was not their fault. And it's you know, mad. And I think this going also back to the state pension one as well, Tanya, just very briefly, again, just more dogged, tireless determination for Tanya, never letting things drop. And we had the weight of Steve Webb behind that one as well. It's so much unjust all the time with our finances, Georgie. And, you know, we are always trying to get things that are wrong sorted, whether it's government departments, whether it's massive private companies. And Tanya is always there just trying to shake it out of them and getting the right changes and making sure that people are treated fairly. And as always, I salute Tanya for that.
Aye, don't we all? Tanya, one of the nicest people around, but I tell you what, I wouldn't like to be a bad pension company or the government or HMRC. Oh, little terrier. Tanya, I'm glad you stuck around for that. Goodbye, Tanya. Thank you so much. And thank you for all the work you do. She's a busy lady. Right, finally to another busy lady. Helen, Crane is back on the case. This time over a very expensive robot vacuum that, well, it didn't work, which is not ideal. What's going on here, Helen?
Yeah, so this is about a Roomba, which I don't know if people listening will be familiar with these, but it's a little robot vacuum cleaner. It's like a little disc. It's about the size of, what's it about the size of? A cake, a bit like the size of a sponge cake. That's like
a big cake,
smallest round thing that I could think of. Anyway, it's a robot, so you program it, and then it just like shuffles around your floor on its own, just doing your hoovering for you, doing your vacuuming for you. Sorry, I shouldn't say the word hoover because that is a registered trademark. Doing your vacuuming for you. So I think they're quite cool. I wouldn't pay. So these cost £889, at least the one this reader bought did. I wouldn't pay that much for one. But if they were cheaper, I think I'd like a little robot doing my vacuuming for me. I think it sounds quite good. People in the comments definitely disagreed. People in the comments are saying, why are you so lazy? Clean your own floor, serves you right. I don't mind
being lazy, but I think practically, though, it's round. How does it fit in corners? It doesn't go up the stairs. Unless it's a proper, fully functioning, it's going to walk around and actually clean absolutely every corner. I don't see the point of it.
Yeah, I mean, good point. It's not an actual purses. I'm sure you could do a better job, Georgie.
No. I mean, let's not go that far, Helen.
But for lazy people like me who don't mind a dusty corner, I would certainly get one if they're cheaper. But anyway, this reader, he bought his £889 Roomba, and after only a few months, it basically stopped working. So it would only clean for a few minutes and then it would stop, and it would play something that it's called the I'm Finished tune, which sounds quite cute. I quite like this. Like, it's like having a pet, isn't it? It's just like having a little pet that cleans your house. And I have a friend who's got one, actually, and he gave it a name. And yeah, you can track it around a little app. So I think it's very cute. Anyway, it stopped working, and he obviously called the company who makes these Roombas. The company's called iRobot. He didn't get through to them for an hour, which is a bad start straight away. So he hung up, sent an email. Eventually someone called him back and talked him through some ways to fix it. But that didn't work. So he emailed them again. And this kind of started off this just series of events where he's just constantly ignored by this company, which I think is really bad, considering, you know, he's bought a really expensive product from them. And you know, this should be a simple, you know, it's broken, so we're going to refund you, or we're going to give you a replacement. Yeah. They've ignored him, just completely ignored him, about 8 or 9 times. He finally got a call from someone, and he called them again, sorry. And the person he was speaking to said he couldn't raise a complaint and they couldn't transfer the call, but someone would call him back. Yeah, and then they never did, obviously. Followed up with some more emails. He'd just been completely ignored by this company, which I just find quite obscene, to be honest. Like, in the level, like, you know, I see people getting ignored by companies all the time, but the level of ignoration in this is quite extreme. So he ended up getting in touch with me. Another thing to mention, actually, the Roomba had a 2-year warranty, so it should have been a really simple thing for them to swap. He got in touch with me, obviously really frustrated. So I said, yeah, happy to get in touch with iRobot. Drop them a line saying, you know, this happened, he'd like a replacement, can you help? They didn't actually get back to me for a few weeks, which also isn't a very good sign. I don't know who they've got like working in their contact center, but they're clearly not up to much, in my opinion. And then a really strange thing happened. So I got an email, not back from iRobot, but back from the reader. A really kind of stilted email saying, oh, thanks for your help, but I can't talk to you about this anymore. And this is something this is just what I think has happened. But based on my experience of this having happened to me before, I'm fairly certain I'm right. So I'm seeing this more and more. Companies will, when I get in touch with them, they'll sort of say to the, they'll get in touch with a person and say, look, this journalist has been in touch with us, this pesky journalist. You know, we're happy to sort this out for you, but we don't really want this story coming out. So how about we pay you back, or we give you a replacement if you tell this journalist to leave us well alone and not publish a story. And it does really frustrate me. You know, I completely understand why the reader just wanted his money back, and, you know, that's fair enough. But I just think that the gall of companies doing this, and in cases like this where it was a really simple thing that they should, you know, it's not like this has been some long, complicated, you know, issue that it would have been difficult for them to solve. He just wanted them to send him another vacuum cleaner. And it is only when companies go in like this. So I thought, you know, I really want to write the story anyway to say, actually, no, you can't just pull these tactics and it'll go away. I am actually... You know, so I don't actually know what happened to this reading. I have a very strong suspicion that he got his money back, and then that's why he told me to leave iRobot alone. But yeah, I just wanted to get it out there, really.
No,
just,
I'm glad you said that.
A bit of frustration.
Good for you, because we don't hear about those sorts of things, like what happens, you know. And a lot of journalists might have said, oh, well, you know what, I can't carry this story forward. But actually, I think the moral of the story is still absolutely relevant. What a shoddy, shoddy company. I mean, let's be honest, I wouldn't have bought one of these anyway. We've all got our own stories about these sort of vacuum cleaners. But how poor is that? Well done, Helen.
I really do dislike it when companies do that. You know, they've had a chance to fix it in the first instance by the customer actually just going through the right channels, phoning up customer services, trying to get it sorted off their own back. Then feel so desperate that they have to come to financial journalists, personal finance journalists, and you know, consumer kind of experts like Helen. And then we get all of the kind of ducks in a row. You know, we speak to the person involved, we get all the details, everything we can possibly kind of muster up to then send over to said company. And then, you know, there's two things that might happen from there. You know, either the company sort of holds up their hands and fixes the problem and does the right thing and comes back with a comment, or they sort of like don't respond. And then you don't quite know what's going on. And then you have to chase out the reader again. And the reader's kind of like, well, actually, they did get in touch with me and they've told me not to talk to you anymore. Otherwise, they won't sort the problem out. Actually, that is like a red rag to a bull, for personal finance journalists. And we've had time and time again over the many years that I've been a financial journalist. And it just riles us up more and makes us want to write the story more. And the thing is, with something like this, we had all the details anyway, so we didn't need to speak to the customer anymore, the reader anymore. All we don't know is whether he got his money back or not, and all we can assume is that he has, because he can't talk to us anymore. But we had all the details anyway, so we can still write the story. That doesn't get them to shut the story down. And we will continue to do things like this. It needs to be out there that happened. And I'm glad that Helen wrote that in the column this week. And it shows you, again, like I just said with Tanya, the amount of work and the amount of admin that goes on behind the scenes for a lot of these stories. You know, sometimes you don't see it. You don't need to see it as a reader. You don't need to see it. But we have to make sure that, you know, we've got everything lined up and it's prim and proper and everything is as it should be. But it takes a lot of work behind the scenes. And in the same breath, you know, sometimes we get readers right in, and they lead us completely down the garden path, and we reach a dead end because they failed to mention, you know, a key piece of information. You know, it can happen that way as well. And it can feel like a huge waste of time sometimes when you chase these kind of things. And it's tireless work, and it's always going on behind in the background.
I suppose it's important to point out that this may not have been the case. They may not have put pressure on the customer to pull the story. However, what is completely shoddy is the treatment and how long it took this person to call them up, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, if anyone has had that kind of experience here, I imagine let Helen know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, get in touch. Always. We're always, always, always. We've said this recently, didn't we? We're always... want people to get in touch. Helen, we'll give her email address up right now, won't you, Helen, for people to get in touch with these kind of consumer problems.
I will, but first, can I read out the comment from iRobot? Did they dig it back to me in the end? And I'm just going to leave this out there for the readers to hear. No commentary from me. As a customer first organisation, iRobot's award-winning care team is committed to providing customers with an exceptional level of service. There you go.
Right. Customer first. Okay.
So
I wonder what they think is a shoddy level of service. My goodness me. Sorry, Helen.
No, that's okay. If anyone has had any problems with a retailer like this, bank, energy firm, almost any kind of company that you have given money to, do drop me a line. It's helen.crane@thisismoney.co.uk. Let me know what happened, when it happened. Give me your permission to speak to the company as well, because companies are quite often ask for that. And if you've got any relevant sort of documents, send over, do that as well. And I will do my best to get back to you and help.
And I will just end this on a cautionary tale. If you were thinking of buying one of these, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to say this, I might cut it out, but I'll say it anyway. My other half has one of these, and we made the mistake of keeping the dog in the kitchen with said iRobot thing overnight. And I was woken up in the middle of the night by shuffling around of my other half, only to get up and see the largest dirty protest all over the kitchen floor. The dog, God bless it, had got a bit upset about being left in the kitchen Anne had expressed her upset on the floor. And the programmed Hoover had then decided to wipe it all over the kitchen floor. I've never smelt anything quite like it, nor seen anything quite like it. But it wasn't my home, wasn't my Hoover, wasn't my dog.
That happened exactly to my friend as well, but instead of a dog, it was a cat. So I wouldn't have thought as messy. But I got to say, Georgie, that was like poetry in motion, your words.
Was it?
It was almost like one of those old M&S adverts. Like, you know, this wasn't just any dirty protest. This was a robot.
Robotic.
Yeah. You made it sound quite glamorous. I mean, we're actually ending this podcast talking about dog poop. S-H-I-T. I mean, I love it. Yeah. I mean,
we cover everything in this podcast. Yeah. Everything. Nothing too low can get in here. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
I really do apologise that is the final part of what you might have been visualising. You've gone from Helen describing a robot Hoover as a nice cake. You know, it started all nicely and then it ended like that. And I can only apologise. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can follow us and tweet us on X @thisismoney. And you can also leave reader comments where this podcast lives.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.